Greetings to you, my sweet friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and I'm on cloud nine right now. I just recorded my first comedy special this last weekend at the Comedy Mothership, and it was just the most wonderful weekend. And to all of you who came out to the shows, thank you so much. That was just, I don't have words for it. I can't explain it. The Mothership is the coolest place ever. The comedians there, the staff there are just so sweet and supportive. And I don't know, y'all, I am just buzzing with joy right now. I have been putting off doing a special forever. And you know, how is it going to turn out? I don't know. The shows were great, but still, you know, we got to edit it. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I have a feeling it's going to be really good. Lance Bangs directed it. He set everything up perfectly. The Mothership is beautiful. I've been working on these jokes forever. So hopefully within the next few months, you all will be able to see my first comedy special. And again, let me just put in italics. Thank you, everyone who came out. Some of you flew to Austin to watch the special, which means the world to me, and I will never be able to thank you enough for giving me the ability to even be a comic, to have this awesome job as a podcaster, and to be able to you know, have the luck to have one of the weirdest jobs on earth, feed my kids. So thank you all so much. I am overjoyed. And also I am a little, as you can hear from my voice, ragged. So I'm not going to go on and on rambling about how happy I am about my comedy special. And I don't need to go on and on because today we have a star guest, Whitney Cummings is here with us today. Now, before we jump into that, I would like to invite you to join my Patreon. It's at patreon.com/DTFH. We have weekly gatherings and meditations, and you will get access to commercial-free episodes of this podcast. Friends, I am taking a little break from the road because I have a new being coming into my life. And I want to be here for that, obviously. But starting the 8th of September, you can catch me at Zany's in Rosemont. And I'm also going to be at the Tacoma Comedy Club the 21st of September. And then the 6th of October, I'm headed back to San Francisco to do shows at Cobb's. I am getting those ticket links up on the website. But in the meantime, you can go to Zany's, Tacoma, or Cobb's and find ticket links there. All right, everybody, let's dive in to this wonderful conversation with Whitney Cummings, who I was lucky enough to get to hang out with at the Mothership because she did a couple of nights there before I taped my special. And what a hilarious, brilliant person she is. Everybody, if you're interested in, if you have somehow have missed Whitney, she's got like a billion comedy specials. You can find links to all of them at whitneycummings.com. I hope that you will check them out. And now, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Whitney Cummings. Whitney, welcome to the DTFH. It's great to see you. I love your background.
Oh, gosh. I love you. I love this show.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking me.
So, I don't know if people, at least I didn't know that you were a horse person.
I'm a horse person. And you know what? That I'm trying to figure out what you mean by that, because for there's good horse people and then there's really obnoxious horse people. There's two kinds of horse people. There's the horse people that, like, growing up, they were rich and had horses and, like, rode English and jumped, which is usually abuse. But for a lot of girls, it's the way they basically masturbate for the first time.
No way.
Swear to God.
I guess it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. It totally makes sense. That's sort of wrapped up in learning to ride a horse.
I was never having sex with my horse growing up, just to be very clear.
Got it. But you are on a saddle. We've all seen a Sibian by now. We know what that is. It's like a living, organic Sibian that you are probably getting really confused riding.
It's the more expensive model. And so I grew up in a home that very alcoholic home, you know, who didn't? And I luckily got sent away when I was like 10. We were running away from home, doing drugs really early to go live with my aunts on this farm with horses. And I was, again, more alcoholism in those homes. So I spent most of my time out in the fields with the horses, kind of just pretending I was one. I mean, because their behavior is so fair, the pecking order of the herd, you know, the way that they move, the way that they treat each other. I just really appreciated that honest, direct communication. They're prey animals, so they don't really have any bandwidth or energy. I'm sorry. Because they're not predators and because they only graze.
God.
Yeah. Actually, horses are incredibly violent in the wild. I don't know if you've ever seen horses fight.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal.
It's bonkers, dude. They can really bite the shit out of each other and they paw each other with their hooves. And in the wild, you don't shave their hooves down like those Sable Island horses. So they have these kind of hook hooves.
Ooh.
And they can just take chunks out of each other. It's wild. But that horse is probably going to die soon if its hoof is like that. So they really have to be violent to protect themselves. But so I kind of would sleep with them, hang out with them. I appreciated so much like the way that they conserved energy, the way that they communicated with each other. And that kind of helped me understand how to be direct in communication because I grew up with so much bullshit. You know, it's like you'd go to church and they'd be like, be good to your neighbor. And then you'd see your parents at home do the exact opposite, you know?
Right.
And horses, like, they don't lie. And any other emotion, you know, besides just, like, serenity and being present repels them. It all boils down to fear for them, you know? So they just want to be away from you. So it's a great way to, like – so I now do more, like, equine therapy, Agala stuff.
All right. First of all, this is my not that I have a problem with any life form, but as a neurotic person – like I could be fine around an animal, but the moment someone tells me it is hyper attuned to any fear or weird feeling you might have, that at that moment, I'm going to fail the equine lie detector test. Cause it's like, Jesus fucking Christ. What do you mean? How much does it know about me? Like it senses everything. Oh fuck. It's going to know. It's going to see me. And then I'm going to freak out. And then the horse is going to be like, get this fucking asshole away from me. What is wrong with him?
Actually, the energy you're emitting right now, they would love because it's honest. So if you're scared and you go in and go, I'm not scared of horses. They don't understand that. Like it's almost like the uncanny valley to them because they feel your energy is fear, but then they see you trying to cover. So they just think you're like sick.
Right.
And they're repelled from you. If you're pretending and lying, they don't understand that. So if you're going, I'm scared shitless. I'm scared you're going to find me out. They'll move towards you. They fuck with you.
Wow. Okay. I got it. Well, that makes more sense. I wish that I'd had you as a horse instructor back in my summer camp days because I had a horse riding and I rode horses. And at first it was really quite scary. But then, you know, you realize it's like, especially these horses, these were camp horses. They weren't exactly like purebreds or whatever you call them.
Well, they probably were like shut down. Most of the horses we see, their spirit is broken.
So sad.
And they're not like awake. So what I do with horses, I take abused horses and we make them wild again. We give them sort of permission to express themselves and be individual and make their own choices. All the riding is consensual. And I know that's, you know... Horses, yes, they do like to work. They do like to ride depending on the circumstances. But you really learn a lot about your own motives when you approach them this way. And we realize how results-oriented we are and how gross our motives are. I'm like, I'll be in the arena just doing an Agala session. and my horse will move away from me. And I'm like, what? Like, what? Well, what? Is there food over there? And I'm like, no, I was thinking about getting a video.
Right.
I was like reaching for my phone. I wanted to get a video of us. And that just boils down to them, to fear. I'm afraid I'm not going to get this photo. I'm afraid I'm not going to have something to post today. Like, they just feel it and it repels them.
That is so cool. I don't think people realize how smart they are either. I think that, you know, just because they, unless you really like see them, then they can seem just kind of like, I don't know, not there, dumb. But then when you tune into their intelligence, there used to be a horse. I would go jogging in LA and there was a horse there. And then I somehow just caught like, shit, that thing is smart. Like it's like sentient. It's aware in the moment, just like what you're saying. I recognize that for the first time it walked right to me and it was, I was like, whoa, I summoned it. It came to me.
It's cool. When a horse chooses, you know, to spend time with you. Also, I'm fascinated by, you know, the sort of history of, I mean, horses fought wars for us. Horses took us to hospitals. Like horses, you know, cars is based on horsepower. We look at like the history of every country and horses are integral to basically every civilization. And we're kind of one of the first, I guess, in the last like couple hundred years that disrespects them this much. You know, they were, it's like, you know, in Egypt when cats were gods and, you know, they were, you know, it's like horses, the way that we treat them based on what they've done for us is, I don't know, I have some kind of weird epigenetic. I don't know if you're into Family Constellation.
I have heard about this so many times and I feel a lot about it. Like I feel about ayahuasca. I'm afraid of it. Like, but just because everyone who like has told me stories about it, it sounds batshit, like in a good way. Like impossible, some of the stuff that like, but maybe you could explain it to people who haven't heard of it.
It's interesting to me. I'm so back and forth on it because I also think that we don't realize how much information we give away to a new person. And if someone is just being observant and not thinking about what they're going to say next or trying to perform, you can actually get a lot of information. Like I used to go to this psychic and I'd be like, she's so psychic. But like, I realized I was giving everything away. Not that she wasn't, but you know, she'd be like, so tell me what's going on in your dating life. And I'd be like, well, you know, I really like this guy, Tom, you know, and I think it could work. But like, John is like, John, and she'd be like, well, it's John. But I just gave that information away with my inflections and my body language. And I'm like, how did you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like the same thing with horses when, you know, people are like, they're so perceptive. Like, I think humans, I think we are too, but we're just so in our own ass and on our phones and focused on ourselves and our narcissistic need to be liked and make a conversation funny and thinking about what we're going to say next that like, we're actually really not listening to people. When you really just sit and listen, you're like, oh, I can like feel your energy. You're scared. You're nervous. Like I think we've just shut off that antenna of ourselves. We've numbed it a little bit. And who knows what else? Maybe it's the Roundup in our bloodstream. Who fucking knows? But Family Constellation, the idea is like epigenetic imprinting. There's a ton of evidence that that is super legitimate. Like, you know, rats that were electrocuted while smelling cherry blossoms, their offspring, when they smelled cherry blossoms, recoiled to the other side of the cage.
Right.
So imprinted on your DNA a fear that was just one generation, right?
Right.
The question is, can we imprint guilt and shame and carry it epigenetically without it being nurture from your parents putting it on you? You know? So I do this family constellation. I've got, you know, a lot of alcoholism in my family. Look, my family are white people from Appalachia, who knows what horrific shit they were up to, right?
Right.
I have a lot of, come from West Virginia, like John Brown, Hatfield McCoy, coal mining. I had trouble with kind of agoraphobia, small spaces, loud noises, misophonia. Is this, you know, something I made up myself? Is this, why are noises so loud to me? A lot of coal mining ancestry tends to have that. Again, maybe it's nature, maybe it's nurture. Maybe I saw my grandfather be weird about it and I just modeled him, monkey see, monkey do, or maybe it was imprinted on my genes, who knows? Or maybe I'm exaggerating, whatever. Autism, Asperger's, I was diagnosed with all of it. And so the biggest kind of problem I had that was debilitating fear, besides jellyfish, that's the only other thing I'm afraid of.
Fuck those things.
Dude, I have a, I think that's probably normal. You know, when someone's like, I'm afraid of heights, I'm like, I think you should be. Yeah. I think that means we evolved properly, but jellyfish are just thinking about them piss me off.
And yeah, they're like poisonous ocean chandeliers. They're terrible. They're terrifying. Some of the stings they say are the worst. It's the worst pain you'll ever experience. You'll want to kill yourself. And they're kind of beautiful. They just float out there, just so sweet and beautiful. And you get close, you're doomed. Portuguese man of war.
That's what's so upsetting about it is they are so graceful and gorgeous and enticing, like the sirens. You know, you kind of like, and they're clear. So you're like, how bad could this be?
How could it be?
You're diaphanous. You're like a gorgeous crystal. And I love octopuses. I think it's not octopi anymore.
I think it's octopi. I just looked it up with my kid. It's octopi, but I think you could also say octopus. I think you say either or.
Octopuses goes way worse in a conversation. So I'm glad that.
Yeah, it does. It does go way worse, unfortunately. But yeah, I like an octopi, whatever the fuck. Those things, they're terrifying looking, but I don't think they're even remotely as deadly as the jellyfish, unless it's a giant
octopus. I think octopi are actually kind of, if there's aliens, I mean, that's my vote is octopi. I mean, they've got hearts in every leg. They're incredibly smart. Like,
yeah.
The fact that we eat them, I'm sure we're going to look back and be horrified one day.
I stopped.
I haven't in years.
I stopped when I heard about it. And I know, I think doing your what you eat based on intelligence, I think this is a pretty fucked up thing anyway. Like, so where is it okay to eat something?
It's
like
tricky.
What if, let's say you have, I don't know, a human that has been in a horrific accident and has a lower intelligence than the octopus that you are not going to eat. Can you eat that human?
I mean, look, I bet humans are pretty bad for you, given everything that's in our bloodstream at this point. Do we know what humans taste like yet?
Yeah, what do they call it? Long pig? They call it long pig.
What do you mean long pig?
That's a name for human meat. Long
Is
pig.
That true?
Yeah, long pig. Like Dumb it tastes pig. Like, I think we taste like pork.
Really?
Yeah. Plenty of cases of people eating people. And now that they can grow lab-grown meat, it'll probably become like...
Lab-grown human meat? Do you think we'll start doing
that? Well, as we plunge into our dystopian transhumanist future, why not? It's like, what kind of meat do you want? It was grown in a lab. It's not from a human.
Lab-grown human meat? Do you think we'll start
doing
that?
Well, as we plunge into our dystopian transhumanist future, why not? It's like, what kind of meat do you want? It was grown in a lab. It's not from a human.
Like, so, yeah, if you had to eat someone, like you had to.
Had to.
Who would you eat? Like, would you go, I'm going to eat, if they wouldn't know or whatever, would you go for like, Joe, someone super healthy who's probably been eating super healthy, or would
my
you want
to? My friend, no way.
Yeah, I just mean he wouldn't know you were eating him. I just mean, what type of human would you want to go for? A muscly human, or are you going to want to go for more of a
grass-fed?
Would you want to eat a vegan or someone on the carnivore diet?
I want free-range grass-fed. Kind of like the Wagyu style, like, you know, nice marbled fat that is like, and also if I don't know how like extensive my ability to choose this unfortunate person is, but cannibal fetish. You know what I mean? One of those people who want to get eaten. So that,
that's a thing, isn't it?
Yeah. There's people who like somehow that's their dream is to get eaten. I mean, of all the fetishes.
Are they masturbating during the feast?
You know, for some reason, like I can get into some pretty dark stuff, but for some reason, the people who want to get eaten fetish thing, I kind of avoid it. So I'm assuming that the charge comes from the lead up. You know, you're meeting the person who's going to eat you. You're going out to drinks with them. Theoretically, you're eating together and you're watching them eat and thinking that's going to be me.
The adrenaline, I know there's a big, I had Angela White, the adult thespian, on my podcast. Whoa. And she talked about her main bread and butter of OnlyFans that is requested of her is men being shrunk, and she'll shrink them in some Final Cut, you know, program, and then eat them.
Yeah, that's a big one. The little tiny man being consumed by a giant woman.
Or she'll put him in her pocket, you know, carry them around type of thing. Remember Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Yeah, that's a dream for many. There
was a lot of movies there for a while where horrific things were happening, and they were just like I rewatched Charlie and the Chocolate Factory recently, and I was like, this is horrifying.
Horrifying. The movie is fucking horrifying. It's obnoxious parables. I mean, and it's boring. I mean, it gets so boring. The movie is the beginning. If you're talking about the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, everyone just wants to get in the fucking factory. They spend the first half of the movie on that stupid ticket, and it's so boring.
I know. As a kid, I thought it was about greed and chocolate or whatever. As you get older, you're like, oh, this is about bad parenting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the woman that let her kid watch too much TV, the kid that spoiled her son, the gluttonous kid that got sucked up into the chocolate thing. But then I got really into the background. There was a midget. Sorry, what do we say? What do we call him now?
Oh, honestly, I'm not sure. I don't know what the appropriate terminology is for it right now. I think is it little people?
Elf.
Or is it, I think it might be little people.
Old Wait, toddler.
Old toddler's pretty good. Well, that's interesting because apparently one of the names for an enlightened being in Tibetan Buddhism translates into old dog. So old toddlers.
What about gnome?
I mean, I think that isn't more the energy behind the designation than the thing itself. Like if you're saying any of those with a like something special about you because your body grew to a certain fucking height, then you're just an idiot anyway. But if you're just authentically like trying to come up with a way to say it that doesn't make them feel like shit, then I imagine they would be okay. They
How would about human that. Being?
Yeah. What? Why do we have to fucking label everything? What
How
the
about
fuck?
Human being.
Yeah.
The height in this story doesn't really matter, honestly. I don't even need to specify the height. It is weird. And also, you know, you've gotten some weird texts from me recently. I've been studying the giants that used to roam the earth. We're technically midgets to them. So maybe we're the midgets.
Everything got smaller, apparently, as the ecosystem of the earth began to change. Like everything shrunk down, trees, everything. So I love the dream of the Nephilim that at one point there were these giants wandering around. Why not? Why not?
And apparently they had a very intense sex drive. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, like, yeah, for sure. Like that's, we're some kind of like, a, like hybrid of like, you know, this all goes back to, you know, all the different forms of humans that apparently once lived, the Neanderthal, all of them. I don't know all their names, but they were fucking for sure. And it was that form of breeding that created us. Like I wish I could remember the name of the book I was just listening to. The premise essentially being we're just an amalgam of stuff. The thing we call a human is not just, you know, interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans and all the other things that are dead now, but also the genetic changes that came from different diseases that have altered our DNA and all that, that we're just a crazy, crazy mishmash of genetic stuff that's made us, that we're just getting swirled together. Yeah.
Do you think it gets awkward? Like when tell me if this is untrue, that the idea that the penis evolved to be curved with that ridge on the end in order to scoop out semen of the competitor.
We'll never know for sure. I've certainly heard that theory. That's from this book, Sex at Dawn, or at least that's where I read it. Mm-hmm. You have to wonder, you know, like why and you know,
unless it's a scoop at your own semen.
yeah, like fuck, we gotta fix this.
No thanks, no.
No.
I didn't know.
No. Evolve my dick, planet. Just stop this. We'll never know. I mean, I love all the mystery. I love the mystery behind being human, and I love the certainty that many people seem to have regarding their origin, which is, I guess, comforting or something like that. But
yeah.
The general, like, I think the scientific materialist viewpoint by itself is, I think, shocking enough, which is that you are more bacteria, right, than human. Like, you're much more, like, what you think of as you mm-hmm. is like looking at a tree. I heard this description somewhere. It's looking at a tree with vines wrapping around it and birds' nests in it and bees flying around and honeycombs and like animals living inside hollow in the tree. That's a human. It's not any one. You can't really find any one thing that we are. We're this harmonization of all these different things, some of them that have completely different genetic signatures than what we have. So we're just a temporary, like, sort of collaborative mist, I guess, that looks like a human.
That's such a trip. And like to get into the wormhole of back to the growing up around horses, I'm so fascinated by prey animal behavior because they don't really have time to luxuriate in ego or indulgence. It's really just right. like, you know, they have to be very economical with their energy and they're incredibly right. psychic, sure is the word. You know, there's all these amazing stories about horses that wouldn't go under a bridge and they're beating them and they can't get them to go under the bridge. And then 24 hours later, it collapses.
Wow.
You know, they can feel the weather. They can, you know, they can tell, you know, 500 yards away if a mountain lion's hungry or not. You know, they yes. can sort of feel the energy. And I used to watch horses eating grass. And there's something very gratifying about your animal eating lush grass. And you want to bring them over to the grass that you think looks the most delicious, right? And they're eating the grass. And then all of a sudden, the lead mare would move to a different patch of grass that was maybe not as lush or something or green. And you're like, why'd you guys move over there? Like, why? Why? And I never understood, and it would like frustrate me because I would like sit on a rock to sit with them, and they would move, you know, down the hill yeah. to this different patch of grass. And I was reading recently about, I think it was in David Agus's new book, which I don't think is out yet, but it's sort of about the wisdom of all the animals that came before us that have been alive for, you know, millions of years, and we've been yeah. alive for 10 seconds, and that plants actually kind of communicate with each other. So when one patch of grass is being eaten, the way the wind is blowing is going to send whether it's an odor, whether it's a smell down to grass near it, and the right. grass down the line from it is going to become more sour and less appetizing. So the horses wow. have to move to a new path as a way Whoa. To stay alive, which is
wow,
kind of mind blowing.
Yeah. I wish I could remember it exactly. That Mitch Hedberg joke, something about how he's glad, like how scary the ocean would be if fish could scream. Such a good joke.
Oh God!
So like, we don't want to think about it. All the no. forms of screaming that are happening around us at any given moment. Like it would be overwhelming for a human to be tuned into that level of suffering around them at all times.
We have to go numb, you know. Like, but isn't David Foster Wallace's Consider the Lobster? Doesn't he say that lobsters scream?
Yeah. No. I mean, I think that. What we're talking about in Buddhism, it's one of the root causes of suffering is ignorance. And so ignorance doesn't mean dumb. Ignorance means the practice of ignoring. And so the more talented you are at ignoring things, the more you're going to suffer, even though it would seem to be the opposite. Like the idea is if I don't ignore this, I'm going to be like, and I'm going to be heartbroken or you name it. But the reality is something about the energy it takes to sort of ignore the reality of the world you're in is draining and sort of takes all the color out of life and does exactly, I think, what you were getting at with it does the opposite of what's happening with horses, which is if you're a prey animal, you have to really be in tune with truth as things are, just the way they are, and no latency in your reactivity to that truth. With humans, We have managed the opposite, I guess, which is we think if we detune ourselves from reality, somehow we will be more efficient in our day-to-day existence. And you are, in a way. I mean, how are you going to run capitalism if everyone is hearing grass scream and like
everyone's... But it's also like there's two things you have to face if you're not... Well, the first question is denial / ignorance. How much of it's a choice? Like, I've been in denial before and have looked back in life and been like, whether it was someone around me had a really intense drug problem, whether I was smoking too much weed and, you know, whatever, denial or in a relationship where it's obviously incredibly toxic and, you know, whether you're chemically addicted to the adrenaline or it recreates your childhood circumstances, whatever. But I'm like, that cloak of denial that I had, like, that wasn't a choice. How many I don't think it was, at least. Maybe I was too high on adrenaline and whatever, or busy to even have the other choice. But the other question is, when you choose ignorance, the opposite is sometimes having to face how powerless you are. And that can be crushing. The idea of like, yes, you know, fish are screaming and this horrible stuff is, and it's karmically destroying us and filling us with shame. But like, what am I going to do about it? So I might as well ignore it, because otherwise I have to face how tiny and minuscule and useless I am. Yes, you know, fish are screaming and this horrible stuff is, and it's karmically destroying us and filling us with shame. But like, what am I going to do about it? So I might as well ignore it, because otherwise I have to face how tiny and minuscule and useless I am.
It's pulling the covers over your head. It's like, that is not going to protect you. But if you're a kid, you might imagine pulling the covers over your head is somehow keeping you safe, when you're just probably even more vulnerable because now you can't see what's outside the covers. It's the same idea. And as far as it being a choice or not, I mean, you know, that's the saddest. We just want to find where we went wrong. And like, if you think, oh, this whole time I had a choice to not ignore my life, it just gives you more reasons to beat yourself up. Probably, it doesn't even matter. It's like, I guess the essence of the thing is like, what do you have the courage right now to just feel the way you're feeling? And that is a choice. And you definitely don't have a choice regarding anything in the past.
And I think I just hit on something that, firstly, I think that having to not ignore something, you know, there's the powerlessness that you would feel that I can't solve this problem. Or maybe that's just my personality type, that I'm like, if I see a problem and I can't solve it, I like hate myself. And like, maybe that's me playing God, being like, well, I just failed because I didn't fix that. Like, that's arrogant. But also ignoring things, the death by a thousand cuts of shame that I think we accumulate over time. And it's like, I get older, I realize that like little, just like those little shame hits you get every day by kind of making the immature choice or choosing to avoid discomfort, which seems like such an epidemic. And I'm so curious how you're parenting in terms of like making sure your children have some adversity, but you obviously just want to protect them. But I see this like atrophying of people being able to tolerate even the smallest levels of discomfort.
Idiot compassion is the name for it. You and I get it. As a parent, you see your kids and you love them so much that it would be easy to get confused and think that the correct choice every time is to save them from whatever particular encounter with suffering they're having. And a lot of times it is definitely the right choice. But yeah, sometimes you got to let them struggle a little bit and let them like experience the reality of the learning curve. You know, that's the main, that to me is the for me, that anytime my kid, it was so funny the other day, you know, my kid, both of them are like learning how to scooter now. And so I keep trying to like explain to them, like, look, you know, the only way you're going to get good at this is falling down. Like there's no way to get good at this in any other way. You're going to fall down, it'll hurt, you'll get back up, you keep trying. And I got this skateboard out And I'm like, you know, so I just been giving this lecture about how you just get right back up. I get this fucking skateboard out. And I'm like, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to ollie and I never could. But you know what? I'm going to try. So I tell you know how it goes. I try to ollie. I wipe out. My 48-year-old body smashes into the sidewalk. I could have broken a hip. I had just given a lecture. You keep trying. You get back up. And like, this isn't a young body falling. They're laughing their asses off at me. Laughing and laughing.
Are you okay? I'm sorry. I should have asked that.
No, I was, thank God I was fine. I mean, but, and I had to like demonstrate to them at least a couple more times. Like, yeah, gotta get right back up. Try this again. Tried it a few more times. Like, there you go. I never will get on a skateboard again, probably. But yeah. Well,
it's interesting though, because I look at like in the 1905, parents would drop their children off at factories to go to work.
Yeah.
They would drop their kid off at the Triangle Shirtwaist factory and then they would go to their work. And so now we like won't even let our kids eat peanut butter. Like, it's like fascinating to me.
Well, you know, I do think like a lot of people right now are confronting a really important question, which is how much suffering do you need to become a better person or evolve? And any? Is it a myth? Is it a myth that stems from industrialization? Like, you look back to pre-industrial society, clearly there was suffering, but it was a different kind of suffering. How much is it military-industrial complex programming? Like, this is like, if we've been at war, what, 93% of our history? Meaning most parents, most dads, a lot of their methods of parenting come directly from what they learned in the military, which is designed to condition people in a way that they don't hesitate when they're like going to kill someone. Is that a good parenting strategy? So who knows? I don't know the answer, but I do know that it's a lot easier to give your kid candy when they want it because it will make them stop whining or yelling or tantruming. So it's an easier choice than to let them tantrum and say, I can't give you candy. You've had too much. Your teeth will fall out. It's bad for you. So I think somewhere in there is the answer to why, like where maybe some parents are going wrong is they've gotten confused and they keep giving the kid candy and thinking this is the right choice. And I'm a good parent. It's like, no, you're not. You're just trying to turn the volume down.
That's it. There's also the selfishness of like, I don't want to tolerate the discomfort of my kid being mad at me. And bingo. I see all these people that, look, I don't know. I'm, you know, having a kid in December. You know, I'm sure that everything I think now will go out the window once you have a crying, pissing, shitting baby in your face. But, you know, I see all my friends trying to be friends with their kids. And I'm like, they don't respect you. You know, for me, I'd rather be respected by my kid than besties with my kid. You know, I come from Southern parenting. You get pinched in the grocery store. You know, there was just, my dad did something once to me that, you know, now that I'm thinking about parenting and what kind of parent am I going to be? And there's a great book called Hunt Gather Parent, which has been, and then the Magical Child.
Write that down.
It's awesome. It's sort of just about like with kids, never bribe them. Allow them to help you before they're capable of helping you. So that even if they make a bigger mess, like if they want to come in and help do the dishes with you, they're not going to be helpful. It's probably going to slow everything down. But parents normally to, you know, for a short-term fix, they'll just go like, oh, no, I'm going to do this. You go play.
Yeah.
And you're basically teaching the kid when mom and dad are working, I play. So then when they're 12 and capable, you're like, do the dishes. And they're like, you know, so train them that it's part of life and it's actually fun and it doesn't have to be a chore. It's expected of you kind of thing. But it's great. And it's also you let your kid explore and you don't micromanage them. Like, you know,
Whitney, you don't have to actually let them wash the dishes. Like, they do want to help. So what you do is you give them like, you give them some, a non-breakable dish, a paper towel, and you say, okay, make sure this is clean. And then they don't know that that isn't an unnecessary job, and it won't, they won't get in the way, and they're not going to cut themselves on a knife or something. So it's it, but I love that idea so much. As far as the bargaining thing goes, I wonder about that a little bit. I know you shouldn't bribe your kids, but then also such a huge part of the way humans interrelate is transaction.
Positive reinforcement, yeah.
And, you know, and deal making and bargaining. And man, I'm telling you, it feels like it's a kind of hardwired into us to bargain, to like, you know, work out like little mini deals. But I get the theory behind it.
Or it's like, maybe I'm conflating it, and maybe it's, you're supposed to do less praise. You know, which I guess, cause then they start craving praise and being addicted to it. I wouldn't know what that's like at all. But yeah, right. my dad did something when I was a teenager that I look back and I really appreciated it. You know, he was very absent, you know, neglectful, not available or capable. His dad was in the war. There was no, I love you. There's one photo of us touching, and it's at my graduation. And he's like, it's like a side hug. And it's so awkward. It's like a producer posing with an actress on a red carpet during Me Too. They're just like, like, no, it's like we never really said I love you. We never hugged, right. Just awkward. And we just play basketball together. That was the only way he could just treat me like a son, was his thing. And so he said to me when, you know, he didn't try to stop us from doing drugs. He would buy us cigarettes. I think his logic was, you're going to do it anyway. So if I just buy you cigarettes, you'll stay in and not ask some weirdo to get them for you, you know? So I'm not defending his decision in the slightest. But he did, when I was like 14, he was like, look, he's like, I know you're going to smoke weed. I know you're going to drink. I know you're going to do whatever this stuff. He's like, if I find out that you were in a car with someone that was drunk, or you drove a car drunk, you'll never leave the house again. But if you call me to come get you, you're completely off the hook.
That's smart.
And it's kind of a big swing of a deal. And I remember one time I was like at 7-Eleven, everyone was smoking weed, and some guy was about to get in the car and drive. And I called my dad from a payphone, and I was like, I smoked weed. This guy's about to, and he's like, I'm on my way. He came and picked me up, and I wasn't punished at all.
That's cool.
I don't know if that's good parenting or not, but it made me tell him the truth and not be scared of him. Yeah. But I still respected him.
Well, see, this is like you. Some people accidentally, it's very sad. They don't even realize they're doing it. But by reacting to the truth in like hyper negative, super defensive ways, they're inviting people to just lie to them. They're sort of like weaving around them a world where people are just, all right, I've tried to tell you the truth a billion times. Every time it goes south. So to preserve my own sort of like day-to-day existence, I guess I have to lie to you from now on, because that's what you're asking for. It's just lies, which is very sad. But at some point, I think that as a parent, you want that. You don't want your kids to feel afraid to tell you the truth. Mm. You don't want them to feel terrified of being who they are around you. Because what you're going to get is a warped, distorted version of who they are, which is you won't even know them. You won't even know them. It'll just be some distortion modeled around what they think you want. That's fucked up. You don't want that. It'll just be some distortion modeled around what they think you want. That's fucked up. You don't want that.
That brings me to something that the way that we model to kids, and I have a question for you, because we lie to our kids so much. Do you do Easter Bunny, Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus?
Yes. And, you know, I've had this discussion with Joe a little bit. The problem is, if you decide to bring them out of that particular reality tunnel and be like, it's nonsense, then you're going to have a kid going to a school where all the other parents have maybe they're more attached to the lie, and then the kid is going to disrupt the reality.
Our kids are definitely the ones that are going to be like, that's bullshit.
There's no Santa Claus.
There's an island of pedophiles. The North Pole is full of pedophiles.
Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself, and there's no Santa Claus. Well, I think I don't know the right answer to that one yet. I struggle with it, but I will. One of my favorite bits of parenting advice I got was from this. He's back there. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He's a Buddhist teacher, but he said like the greatest gift you can give your kids is to be in the present moment with them. So like as much, and that sounds easy, but it isn't. The more you can sort of drop into the moment with your kids, very similar to, I think, the way you are with horses, then they are going to be getting interactions with a person who's also in, because they're in the moment. So dropping into the moment with them will create a connection that is not going to happen if while you're hanging out with them, you're rolling through all the shit you have to do, how busy you are, who you need to email or text back. And it can be really like similar to meditation, I've noticed. You want to not do that. So I think that's a nice gift you can give your kids. And then also not getting too caught up in any particular method, like right. being very fluid in your connection with them, so that you're not caught up in rule sets like, oh, I'm being too much their friend right now, or oh, I'm not being enough their friend, I'm being too authoritative. Just sort of, it seems
don't
like
overthink it. Just be in the flow state.
My meditation teacher says to me, we do this in real time, which I really like, meaning, you know, whatever's happening now is what's happening, and that's it. And I like that.
And back to the epigenetic imprinting and family constellation, which I can close that hatch in a second by segueing with, we also can't control what our kids are inheriting that were our ancestors' stuff too, right? So if it's genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger.
Yeah.
I'm so curious, you know, I have friends that are like, yeah, dude, my son is my dad.
Right.
Like there's stuff that he does that is just my dad, and it's spooky and it's creepy. Like, have you seen anything in your kids that you're like, where did that come from? That's not me. That's not Aaron.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a great book. I think it's called Many Lives, Many Masters.
Oh, cool.
About reincarnation. And so many studies have been done on this strange thing that happens with children up to a certain point. They really seem to remember their past lives. Now, the new biological way of talking about reincarnation is epigenetics, and maybe that's more accurate. Because we really don't know yet everything that gets encoded in there. And what we call past life memories could just as easily be some like coded memory from a distant, distant ancestor. And ultimately all of the same ancestor creating like the, what they call the Akashic records, which is the sum total of all life experiences existing in some unknown medium, which is maybe DNA, who the fuck knows. But yes, I've had, one of them, my wife is Christian, I'm Buddhist. We both sort of don't want to like hammer our particular faiths into our children or encourage, confuse the kids. There's enough going on without confusing them. But anyway, long story short, the oldest like looked at a picture of Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru, and said, I knew him a long, 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 long time ago. He helped me. He gave the best hugs. And it was like, what?
No,
holy shit. Because I've been making like real efforts to not, we have pictures of them all over the house, but, you know, not to like create a situation where he might be encouraged to just make stuff up because his parents get a charge out of it or whatever. But that is not an anomalous event, according to this book. Lots and lots and lots and lots of kids will just, you'll see it with yours, just out of the blue. They will be, they'll use some language to describe some life or some memory that has nothing to do with you. And whatever that is, I don't know, but it's pretty cool. It's so, yeah. So that, like, letting that be and have its own understanding. Ram Dass would say, soul, not role, meaning don't get too caught up in role of parent. That's a very important role. Mm. And you must be, but don't get so caught up in the role of you're the parent and they're the kid that you miss out on. You're both way more than that. And so that you don't sort of box them in to one singular identity. I think that's a really important thing to remember.
And like this, if it's hysterical, it's historical. You know, like I see my friends that have overscheduled their kid or themselves to where their kid doesn't even have a chance to be a child or express themselves or just allow for what comes up. Like, you know, I'll go to a friend's house and I'll be, you know, playing with their kids and the kid will have a histrionic reaction to something. And the parent will go like, oh, he's just dramatic about this at dinner time. Da, da, da. It's like, how do you know this isn't something like from many generations ago? How do you know this isn't something else? You know, EMDR, movement reprogramming and desensitization. It's like, if that works, which is, you know, being able to take the trauma response stimuli. So it's like if someone comes in right now, puts a gun to your head, and you go into the freeze response, everything that you feel, touch, taste, looking at, you're then going to associate with trauma. So
yep.
The microphone, Whitney's brown hair, these headphones, yeah. Your headphones, however it smells in there. So if in 10 years you're looking at a girl that has a similar hairstyle as me right now, all of a sudden you're anxious. You're not sure why. You're irritable. You're like, Aaron, why? Don't talk like that. You're just being, you know, it's your trauma, your brain, your hippocampus is connecting with your amygdala saying last time this happened, shit hit the fan. Yeah. So EMDR sort of neutralizes those stimuli that we don't even realize. Like I had a really bad reaction, comically bad reaction to Christmas. I'd go to malls in October, see the Christmas trees.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, just like, what the fuck is fucking capitalism? And I did EMDR and we were able to rewind and go, oh, a lot of the biggest traumas for kids in alcoholic homes are holidays. That's when everyone's drunk, the family's together.
Yep.
And I was able to go, oh, and I was able to rewire. And now, even though Christmas isn't necessarily my holiday, I do love decorating in December for whatever thing. You know, so who knows what's going on with kids that have nothing to do with us. And the fact that we just diagnose of, oh, he's always dramatic at dinner time or whatever. I'm like, that's not what I'm feeling at all. I feel like this kid is working through some other shit.
Right.
And I feel, I know it because the, you know, I was dating someone who was in New York. I love New York. I don't think it's the place for me to live for a litany of reasons. But when I wanted to live there, my late 20s, early 30s, I couldn't, you know, because there's so many at the time. It was a great place to do stand-up. There's 10 clubs. You can do 10 spots a night. You know, I was dying to live there. But I could not handle the horse carriages. It devastated me.
Yeah.
Like in a way that was an irrational fear.
Sure.
I guess. Yeah. Like if I heard them clomping, I would collapse, sob. One time I was going to do Letterman in Midtown and one of the horses went by and I had to go into some museum in Midtown and just sobbed. I was late for the show.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it sounds nuts. I know it just makes me sound insane.
It sounds that nuts.
You know, because I've been to Vietnam and I've seen dogs in crates outside restaurants, you know, and I was able to go like, okay, it has its own higher power. Okay. It's our, you know, whatever. But with the horse carriages, it just kills me in a way that I can't control because I'm pretty good about, you know, we've been in this business for a long time. You get rejected a lot. You get hurt a lot. Yeah. You swallow it. You ignore it. You push it down. Like, that's kind of where I shine. My mom died. I didn't cry, you know, but this just wrecked me in a way that I couldn't control, understand, explain. That just made me think, oh, I'm a dramatic, over-emotional, whatever, empath, whatever bullshit. And then I did this family constellation work where you're working with somebody, she's putting note cards on the ground with all of your ancestors, right? Your great uncle, your great great uncle, your great cousin, da da da. And every card you stand on, you know, she asks you a question about those relatives. Even just doing research within your family about your relatives is already going to get you some good information. So even if there's not the mystical element of it, it's worth doing. Because I end up calling my uncle and being like, what was up with our great-great-grandfather? You know, what did he do? Oh, he worked on this railroad and lost a finger doing this. And you're like, oh, interesting. So there was one, my great three grandfathers ago, whatever, she said, you carry guilt and shame from this person. person? What did he do? Because he did something unforgivable. And I'm like, well, yeah, probably slavery, probably a lot of things. Cirrhosis, you know, he died of cirrhosis, I found out. Okay, great. So he was an alcoholic, probably beat his wife. That all tracks, right?
Yeah.
And then I call my uncle and I'm like, you know what? I only talked to really one family member. And I was like, what's up with great, great, great grandpa? Like, what did he do? What was he up to? And he goes, well, you know, everyone in our family was a bad businessman, so he actually never patented it. But he invented an axle that kept horse carriages from tearing apart. Yeah. So he was actually very integral in making sure horse carriages could actually function in the South. Like, he invented this thing, but he never patented it and whatever. So it's weird. It's spooky. I'm sure a lot of people worked on horse carriages back then, you know, but the way that he said it was just this guy having a very integral part. And then I'm just like, maybe I carry that shame. Maybe I carry that guilt, you know, or maybe it's just something about the noise that I hear the noise and I associate it with horror. And maybe it's, you know, who knows, you know,
but I love it. I love all the forms of thinking about reincarnation, whether it's epigenetics, trauma in your own life, or whatever you want to call it, because I think it helps you be a little more compassionate with yourself. Because, you know, you understanding, like, I like the reincarnation model better because I like woo-woo stuff. And, you know, recognizing you've been doing this human thing for so long, impossibly, indescribably long, it sort of reduces the getting into a hurry regarding your own personal spiritual evolution, because you didn't get the kind of karma you have in one incarnation. You got it from infinite incarnations. So you're not going to reduce your habitual patterns in one incarnation, probably. Meaning you can now, but that being said, and you know, with spirituality in particular, you have to watch out, because some people who need fucking therapy don't get therapy. They're like, I'm going to meditate the trauma away. I'm going to ayahuasca the trauma away. And it's like, no, you need Western. That is actually, I was always wanting Ram Dass to give me the fix. And the advice he gave me was, you need therapy. And I ignored it. I was like,
talk therapy?
Because he was a great therapist. And he saw in me, I needed fucking therapy. He saw it right away. This kid has got to go to a shrink. And I just didn't do it. And then finally when I did, EDMR, just like you, such a change in my life. I just so wish I had taken him seriously. But all that being said, there is another, so like in one name for what we're calling epigenetics now is the kleshas, which is these sort of spiritual knots that form from many incarnations. These are the kleshas. And so this is all part of having a body and being associated with a body and thinking you're the body. But all of this stuff is happening within emptiness or within, you know, it can't exist without space around it, which is when you're really tangled up in your own identity, you completely miss that all of this is taking place within a non-judgmental field of awareness, which is also you. And so you can actually hold all of that stuff without trying to get rid of it, brutalize it, surgically remove it. If you could just get a little bit of space between you and that stuff, I've noticed like it's a very powerful thing. So you're not trying to annihilate your personality, or do the thing all the psychonauts seem to like be into. Not all of them, but like, I destroyed my fucking ego. I obliterated myself. All this very violent way. Like, don't do that. You don't need to. You can let yourself be.
It's also tricky with the therapy stuff, because I'm like, the things I'm working on are ego, self-obsession, self-absorption. You know, I'm so excited to have a kid. Just thinking, the releasing from the bondage of self, just me. It's so exhausting. And I found myself in my life trying to focus on other people, fix and rescue other people, just anything but me, you know? And as an adult, that's not cute. So I'm glad to actually be able to give caretaking to someone who needs the caretaking, instead of just, because as an adult, it's just meddling, you know, or playing God. But just the sort of, it's so anathema to the way I was thinking when it's like, oh, I want to not think about myself so much. Go to therapy and go think about yourself more and talk about yourself more. Right. I'm like, right. I'm so sick of myself. How do I? But that's not how you get out of your own head, you know?
Well,
so
you give up. You know, there's these wonderful, it's called Lojong Mind Training. There's all these sayings. And my favorite is abandon all hopes of fruition. And when I first started working with my meditation teacher, he said to me, look, I'm going to tell you what my teacher told me, and he meant it. This is hopeless. I was like, yes! Finally, someone says it out loud. And
so that's a good name for a special.
This is hopeless. You know,
just hopeless.
Hopeless. And you know, that sounds really dark to some people, but really what it is if you allow yourself the blasphemous thought experiment that actually you don't need to change anything, actually where you are is exactly right, actually you don't have to be at war with yourself, that that whatever you're doing right now or going through right now, regardless of how other people might be telling you how fucked up it might be, it's just the way you are. Yeah. It's just, this is it. And you really might die in like in 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And what a shame to die being at odds with your identity. And so,
and like, maybe you're nailing it.
You are nailing it. You're nailing it. It's incredible.
Our addiction is to improve ourselves constantly, you know, because of whatever root of self-loathing or whatever, you know. It also helped me to learn about the night watcher theory. You know, I have trouble sleeping for a long time, you know, insomnia, maybe that's why I got into a job where we work late at night, or chicken or egg, who knows. But, you know, the night watchers thousands of years ago in tribes, there were certain people that stayed up all night, obviously, to protect the tribes. And the people that stayed up bred with the nocturnal people, and then they bred to have the superpower of being super hypervigilant come 8, 9 o'clock when the sun goes down. That's when we wake up. Maybe it's growing up in an alcoholic home, and that's also when you have to be alert. There's many things that could be causing it, but that theory helped me go like, maybe I'm just hardwired to have some superpowers that just are kind of obsolete, and I just have to find the places that they're not a liability. You know,
well, you hold you know, it's like you just if you're able, and sometimes I'm not, but you know, if you just hold yourself like a baby. So it's like whatever it is you're going through or doing or all this stuff, and just, man, you just like for a second take a vacation from hating, from doubting yourself, or realize that it's a process. Like you're going to somewhere, and just the moment you allow that process to do its own thing without meddling with it, you just drop all the stories. And so then there's just this, I'm telling you, your horse thing. You just like let yourself be just that way and pretend the universe is the goddamn horse and then see what happens, you know, so that you're just, this is how I am. I'm up all night, I'm freaking out, but that's it. No story about it. No, therefore I'm fucked up or whatever, how sophisticated your story may be. Oh, the times I've pulled that off, it's so cool. It's the best. You're just yourself for a second. Like, this is it.
It's like flying.
No. Yes, it's like flying. Yeah. And if you spent your whole life beating yourself up, whoa, those little micro breaks from pummeling yourself,
it's
love
also
them.
Like, I'd rather be us than like the tools at Lake Havasu that are just like Mike's Hard Lemonading it through life. You know, like I kind of am like, and maybe those aren't the only two options, but I think
honestly, I'm going to try Mike's Hard Lemonading through life. Does that work? Is that a thing? Have you heard of that? Is that real? We got to try it. Don't knock it till you try. We might have to go to Lake Havasu.
You guys, the fact that we're all over here like ayahuasca, DMT, ketamine therapy. I'm like, have you guys tried Mike's Hard Lemonade?
That is the answer. Everyone thinks the Illuminati are in some fucking towers. They're just pounding Mike's Hard Lemonade.
Dude, they go to church every Sunday. They found God. We're still looking.
Whitney, everyone, This is the kind of podcast where I would want it to go on for hours, but unfortunately I fucked up my schedule and I got to bail on my favorite podcast of maybe the year. So I'm sorry, Whitney. I wish we could keep going.
I'll see you in Austin soon.
I'll see you in Austin on your podcast. Maybe we can pick it up from where we left off here.
And sick.
Your shows obviously are completely sold out instantly when they went online, but, or I tell people to come to the shows, but you got anything?
Yeah, you're going to be on them.
I can't wait.
Nice.
Okay, Whitney.
All right. I love you, dude. I'll see you soon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on.
You're the best.
That was Whitney Cummings. Everybody, again, you can find her at whitneycummings.com. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. And thank you for listening. I will see you next week. We've got two podcasts coming out next week. Rabbi Ben Epstein is back with us. It's going to be a wonderful week of podcasting. I will see you then. Hare Krishna.